This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. Sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Imagine no heaven above us, no hell below us. Imagine no religion. This is Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker, and usually Annie Laurie starts the show, but she's not here today. She's traveling. She's in Florida as we are recording today's show. She's speaking at Stetson University about women and religion. And in her place, not as attractive, but a good-looking guy, Andrew Seidel.
Hello, Freethinkers.
FFRF attorney Andrew Seidel is here. And he's not just co-hosting, but he has some exciting news we're going to talk to Andrew about, a case that he spearheaded, a victory out of California. So, Andrew, since you're here today, why don't you do the opening formalities of the show?
Well, this is the April 26, 2014 broadcast of Free Thought Radio. The show is produced and broadcast in Madison, Wisconsin. And we also broadcast in California, New York, Michigan, Missouri, and Texas. And a few days after the broadcast, Free Thought Radio becomes a podcast, which you can hear on iTunes and other online podcast services. Or you can listen directly to the show or any of the archives at ffrf.org/news/radio.
So, you could have a career in radio there, Andrew.
All right.
That's good. A good newsreader. Today's show is the first show of our ninth year of broadcasting Free Thought Radio. We just finished eight full years. Our first broadcast was April the 29th, 2006.
And tomorrow, April 27th, is the birthday of Ulysses S. Grant, born in 1822. He was the 18th president of the United States who served from 1869 to 1877, and Grant said, "Leave the matter of religion to the family altar, the church, and the private schools supported entirely by private contributions. Keep the church and state forever separate."
And that's one of our billboards and one of our bumper stickers, too, that famous Grant quote. And that's what we do here at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We work to keep the state and the church separate. And Free Thought Radio, of course, is produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF, which has two purposes: to keep state and church separate and to educate the public about the views of non-believers. So who are we going to talk to today?
Our guest today will be author, Harvard professor, eminent scientist, and scholar Steven Pinker. I'm very excited.
He doesn't need much of an introduction to our listeners. And as I told you before, we're going to announce a brand new legal victory in the state of California, in which you, Andrew, were quite heavily involved. But first, some other state church news. We talked about last week the display in Daly Plaza, the sign that was put up to counter a religious. Andrew, you and Patrick and Sam went down there, and you guys built our display. Tell us about that.
So we actually built this display in my garage. It was a 12-foot-tall display. And you had three attorneys building it, so we were very concerned with liability more so than the carpentry. But it turns out that we're better carpenters than Jesus. It's still up, it's still standing, and it looks great.
And Jesus is not? Oh, you're better carpenters than Jesus. Well, we covered some of the news last week about that sign, but it made national news. And Annie Laurie was on the national Fox and Friends Friday of last week, which was April the 18th. And we're going to play a little clip of her being interviewed on Fox and Friends and listen to the Freedom From Religion Foundation being compared to the Westboro Baptist Church. Here's Ainsley Earhart of Fox and Friends interviewing Annie Laurie.
The unholy war on Easter, finding a new battleground in the Windy City. The Freedom From Religion Foundation, an atheist group that already posted an anti-Easter sign in the Wisconsin State Capitol, is now erecting a massive display in Chicago's Daly Plaza. 2 8-foot banners featuring Thomas Jefferson and President John Adams, promoting the secular views of our founding fathers, aimed at countering the Jesus in Daley Plaza. Joining us from the Freedom from Religion Foundation, co-president Annie Laurie Gaylor, and from the Faith and Freedom Coalition, Deputy National Field Director Virginia Galloway. Annie, I want to start with you. I want to ask you, if you don't believe that there is life after this earth, why do you care? Why do this?
Well, we believe in the separation of church and state, and we believe that if our public square is going to be taken over by religion, that we should be there too. I don't think we should worry about an afterlife. We should worry about the life that we are leaving our descendants. And today is a good Friday for us here at the Freedom from Religion Foundation, because this marks the 18th anniversary of our federal court victory overturning Good Friday as a state holiday here in Wisconsin.
Well, I just think it's kind of sad that on the week that Christians are celebrating the most significant part of their religion, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that we are attacked and denigrated, and it just seems kind of without class, kind of like the Westboro crowd.
What about manners here? I mean, it's a holy weekend for Christians, and you're putting up signs that say, "In reason we trust."
There's no bad manners in celebrating our secular Constitution. We have a patriotic red, white, and blue display with John Adams and Jefferson. Everybody should be proud of our secular Constitution, but we would not be there with our name and our message if there was not a Catholic group there with a 12-foot Jesus taking over a plaza for 9 days for prayer rallies.
You're also the same group that's condemning what's happening at Clemson University, calling that school and the coach too Christian.
We're not calling them too Christian. We're saying that they have to keep religion out of their coaching at a public university. They have a paid chaplain, and they have led more than 90 prayers in a year. They have baptisms in their athletic department. They have Bible study between drills at Clemson University, a public university, and this is totally unacceptable.
Thank you, ladies. We love you both. God bless you both.
Now, there's objective news. He ends the interview with an atheist saying, "God bless you both." Well, you heard toward the second half of that interview, they talked about Clemson University, which we talked about last week on this show. Their football coach, Dabo, I think that's how you say his name, Dabo or Dabo Swinney. And we talked about those.
Patrick Elliott, my colleague, another staff attorney at FFRF, appeared on Fox News also on The Real Story with Gretchen Carlson Friday, April 18th.
We told you yesterday about accusations facing Clemson's football program and its staff, including head coach Dabo Swinney. Well, a religious watchdog group filing a complaint against the public school for what it deems Christian worship. Patrick Elliott is a staff attorney for Freedom from Religion. And so, Patrick, why go up against Clemson? What are they doing wrong?
You know, we heard from some of our state members in South Carolina about the football program, and we looked into it further. And really, the coaching staff is heavily involved in promoting their religion. They're promoting Bible studies, church services, Bible distributions, and it's really entangled with religion at the university in Clemson.
Yeah, but it's voluntary, right?
Well, it depends on what you mean. Coaches have great authority over their student athletes, including their scholarships, their playing time, and even their potential career.
Have there been any complaints about playing time at all? I mean, with regard to, hey, if you didn't come and get a Bible from me, you didn't play that game?
Well, no, it's certainly a disincentive for any players to speak out against it. They're not going to speak out against their coach when that coach has that authority over them. And so,
have any of the current players or former Clemson players come to you and filed a complaint?
We've had complaints from some within the university, not players. And I think,
so
again,
it didn't affect
because
them
of
then.
The...
So it didn't, any of the people who came to complain to you, they really weren't even part of the program. So number one, they may not even know what was really going on, but they certainly weren't part of the team.
This is a public university that's paid for through taxpayer dollars. So I think all citizens in South Carolina would have an interest in making sure that they're following the Constitution. Well, and secondly, we'd like to see it so that players don't have to continue with
this. They claim that they are following the Constitution, and they've put out a statement to say just that. But since you're sitting in Wisconsin, or your group is at least in Wisconsin, and this is taking place in an entirely different state, what is your end goal here?
We want the university to train their coaching staff and the violations, and ultimately allow players of all religions to participate in this football program.
Yeah.
And so you're certainly talking about this, and you're not in South Carolina. I think a lot of people have an interest in public universities abiding by the U.S. Constitution.
According to the school, a lot of those players who were not Christians say that they never felt intimidated to be able to share their own religion. Got to wrap it there. Patrick, thanks for your time. It's just a shame that this all has to happen around Easter time as well. I wonder if that's planned.
Did you hear that? It's a shame this has to happen around Easter. I wonder if that's planned.
Yes, no. Because we wait until Easter to raise all of our 2,500 legal complaints that we get each year.
Yeah, we wait until Christmas to finally do something. The coach, Swinney, made a public statement about this the other day, saying that it's important to teach our students and our players to be good citizens. Well, one way to teach a student to be a good citizen is to show them that you know how to obey the law, right? So we'll talk more about this. This is not going away. So stay tuned. I'm Dan Barker, and Andrew Seidel, FFRF staff attorney, is trying to take Annie Laurie's place, doing a good job. We're going to talk with Andrew after the break about a great legal victory in California this month. And then we'll be continuing, we'll be inviting back to our show, Steven Pinker. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
Sing and everything the sun kissed me said, don't be late. That's why I can hardly wait. Open up that golden gate, California, here I come.
This is Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
And I'm Andrew Seidel.
Andrew's sitting in for Annie Laurie on this week's show. And California, here I come. I actually was in California last week talking in Sacramento and in Turlock and in Davis and over in Reno. But there's now one more reason to like California. They have stopped praying before city council meetings.
Well, at least in one city, the city of Pismo Beach.
City of Pismo Beach. Well, that's a start. We've been talking in previous shows about our lawsuit challenging official city prayers in Pismo Beach led by a city chaplain, a man who's a Foursquare gospel
Pentecostal preacher.
We wrote letters over the years, and they totally ignored us. People complained, and they ignored that. So we went to court. And now, Andrew, you are one of the FFRF attorneys. They all worked on it to some degree, but you pretty much spearheaded this lawsuit. So tell us what happened on April the 15th.
Well, this is very exciting news. On Tuesday, April the 15th, the Pismo Beach City Council voted to settle the case with the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And as part of that settlement, they are no longer going to have any prayer whatsoever. They're not going to have non-denominational prayers. They're not going to have something that says, Dear Creator. No prayer whatsoever. They're abolishing the position of city chaplain, and they're giving $1 to FFRF in nominal damages, $1 to Dr. Sarit Dwarkin, the brave plaintiff and FFRF member who let us take this case, and then $47,500 in attorney's fees.
Wow. So I thought you were each going to get 20 cents.
A little bit more
splitting,
than that.
Splitting a dollar among five attorneys. Well, isn't that nice when they have to pay our legal costs? You know?
It is, as they should. We gave them many opportunities to stop this lawsuit before it ever happened. You know, I corresponded with them for over a year. Sari went to meetings and actually said publicly at the public comment, please stop praying.
Who's Sari?
Sari is our plaintiff, Dr. Sari Dwarkin.
And she lives in the town.
She lives in the town. We worked with a local group, AUSLO, and they also went to the meetings and asked them to stop praying. And they just ignored us at every turn and continued to let Chaplain Jones, again, a Pentecostal preacher, give these really long-winded, historically inaccurate prayers to Jesus before each meeting.
Now, I remember a year ago, at least, going into your office, and I saw you transcribing and counting and analyzing these. What a job to listen to these prayers for how many, what was it, like six months?
We listened to over 130 prayers, which I think might fall under cruel and unusual punishment for an atheist. So it was difficult, but it was worthwhile because it really made our complaint, our lawsuit, nice and complete, and it made it very difficult for them to come up with any sort of defense, which is one of the reasons we think they wanted to settle so quickly.
So, and you put into the record those prayers, and tell our listeners, I mean, how many were to the Hindu gods, and how many were Jewish?
They gave one Hindu prayer immediately before we sued, and every other one was sectarian Christian. There was one that you maybe could say was more of a deistic or theistic prayer, but it was something like 138 of 140 were sectarian Christian prayers. And they often included exhortations for citizens to live lives according to the Bible. So you should, you know, not be gay, essentially, is one of the things that Chaplain Jones hinted at an awful lot, because that's against the Bible, living a life against the Bible. So really disturbing stuff that he would say in his prayers, and bad history as well.
And he was an official city chaplain?
His title was city chaplain. When he appeared on the video meetings, the videos of the meetings, it said right below him speaking, city chaplain Paul Jones. He was given that title. He was actually, the city proclaimed a day thanking him 1 year for his 60 years of ordained service. So this is a man who basically held a position in city government strictly because he was religious.
Do you think all of the members of the city council were Pentecostals? I mean, how could they stand something like that?
I don't know. Well, I never saw a prayer where he actually broke down and started speaking in tongues. I wonder how long he would have held the position if he had actually did that, which is, you know, something that's common in Pentecostal movements.
Yeah, I know that story. Yeah.
So, yeah. But he never did. So I think they just kind of suffered through it. I don't know whether they agreed with everything he said or not, but the good news is it's no longer happening, and the citizens no longer have to suffer through it.
Didn't he, maybe my memory's wrong, but didn't he turn a city podium with a seal on it to face the audience? He was directing the prayers not at the council members, right? It was at everyone who was in the room, right?
So you're actually thinking of the Greece versus Galloway case, which is before the Supreme Court right now, which is on a very similar issue. It's a town council in Greece, New York, and whether or not their prayers are constitutional. And the Supreme Court's going to hand down that decision anytime, probably within the next 6 weeks.
So why didn't Pismo Beach wait for that decision?
That's a very good question. Because we didn't bring this lawsuit under the federal constitution. We brought it under the California state constitution. So whatever the Supreme Court decides in the Greece case is not going to affect the lawsuit that we had in Pismo Beach, because it was strictly the California constitution and California state law, which is a little bit stronger on these areas. And we were hoping to make some good law. Instead, we got absolutely everything we wanted in a settlement, which is hard to argue with.
Well, you know, and that's kind of the other side of states' rights, isn't it? These religious conservatives like to scream, states' rights. Well, California had the right to make its own law,
absolutely,
its own constitution on these issues.
Absolutely, and it is stronger in many respects than the federal constitution. Many of the state constitutions actually have direct prohibitions on funding written into their constitutions, prohibiting funding to a religious sect, school, things like that. So they are stronger in some respects than the federal constitution, which they're allowed to be.
Can we mention the local council?
Yes, absolutely. Pamela Coslin was amazing throughout this process. She was our local counsel. She actually works down in L.A., but helped us manage this lawsuit. She filed all the paperwork. Was really great to work with. Really, really did a wonderful job. And she'll be collecting her fees out of that $47,500 that we won from the city. So it's very exciting all around, and she was really wonderful to work with. A member of FFRF also.
And we've never actually met her, I don't think, but I remember walking into your office on those conference calls where you and the attorneys and she were talking strategies and should we ask for this, should we say this? So we basically got everything we wanted.
Yes, I mean, this is a total victory, and it's historic. To my knowledge, this is the first lawsuit against government prayer that has ended with there not being any prayer whatsoever. Many of the other cases, they have prayers that are kind of non-sectarian, or they're allowed to give prayers maybe before the meetings or something like that. But in this case, to the best of our knowledge, it is kind of the first. There are no prayers being given whatsoever. It's very exciting.
Yeah, because of the Marsh decision, some cities think that's a green light for them to have at least some kind of a minimal prayer to dear whomever, whatever that might be, sanctify our meeting.
And that's the 1983 Marsh decision that hopefully Greece will revisit. We wrote an amicus brief, FFRF did, to the Supreme Court for the Greece case, saying you should overturn Marsh and you should stop having prayers altogether. I really hope the Supreme Court listens to us. I don't know if they will. We'll have to wait and see, but that's going to happen any time now.
I want to ask you one more thing. How does a settlement like this compare to a decision as far as it's being binding?
So it will be absolutely binding on the city of Pismo Beach. A judge, we expect the judge to sign off on it, which gives it the force of law. So if they were to violate that, they would actually be in contempt of court. They could get fined and they could go to jail. So it's pretty powerful and pretty binding on them.
Is it a precedent for other cities?
Not a necessarily a legal precedent, but it's certainly something we can take to other cities and say, hey, here's what happens if you guys don't listen to us when we say you shouldn't have prayer. You get sued, you lose $50,000, and then you don't have prayer anyway.
Well, so these cities should take notice. Just follow the Constitution. Well, thanks, Andrew, for all your hard work and all the other attorneys at FFRF.
My pleasure, except for listening to the prayers.
You'll get payback in some way. Stay tuned. We're going to talk with Steven Pinker after the break. I'm Dan Barker with Andrew Seidel, and this is Free Thought Radio.
Well, here we are, Pismo Beach and all the clams we can eat.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
And I'm Andrew Seidel.
The Freedom From Religion Foundation is delighted to announce that the world-renowned scientist Steven Pinker, who has already been an honorary FFRF director, will serve as its first honorary president. Listeners to this show know that Steven Pinker is the Harvard professor, the Johnstone Family Professor in Psychology. He's won many awards for his work and his writings. He's also won the Emperor Has No Clothes Award 10 years ago from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, during which acceptance he said, "I was never religious in the theological sense. I never outgrew my conversion to atheist at 13. He's the author of many books. My favorite books are his books are among my favorite books. He also fights religious incursions into government and into education, including when he testified before Congress. He prevailed against a proposal at Harvard that was going to require a course on reason and faith. And he said at that time, universities are about reason, pure and simple. Faith, believing something without good reasons to do so, has no place in anything but a religious institution, and our society has no shortage of these. So, Steve Pinker, we have you on the phone. Welcome back to Free Thought Radio.
Thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you again. I was just watching the TED Talk that you and Rebecca, your wife Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, who is quite an author in her own right, and maybe we'll talk about her new book. But the TED
and a Freedom From Religion Foundation honoree herself.
That's right.
Free Thought,
yeah,
Free Thought heroine.
That's right.
And we are a Freedom From Religion Foundation duly honored couple.
A heroine, so heroin addict. I guess we have here all these heroines of people like Rebecca. Yeah, a powerhouse couple, the two of you. But that TED Talk was kind of interesting, where you were kind of playing off each other, and people can find it online. But talking about morality, does morality come from empathy and emotion, or does it come from reason? So tell us, what was the outcome of your guys' little debate?
Yes, well, she won, I lost. she took the position that that reason drives moral progress, and I tried to make an argument popular among my fellow psychologists that that morality comes only from the gut, that people have unargued gut feelings about what's right or wrong, and then they search for justifications after the fact. And that is certainly true. I think that's a profound discovery of psychology. But it is not the whole story. Because if you look at the history of moral progress, which I believe is a real phenomenon, then at many points, the ball got rolling by arguments, rational arguments, about why some social practice could not be defended. And it certainly did grow by engaging people's emotions. But it looks like the first historical domino was an argument for reason. So you had arguments against the institution of slavery well before there was an abolitionist movement. You had arguments about the rights of women. You had arguments against war arguments against cruel forms of sadistic punishment. And in each case, they eventually prevailed. They were first circulated in pamphlets and books, which sometimes went viral, even before there was an internet. It's surprising how often pamphlets would be translated into a dozen European languages, often criminalized in various countries, but the underground press made them available. And people debated them in pubs and salons and coffee houses and bookstores. And they became increasingly influential and then eventually carried the day.
So we've changed our society through the use of reason. You don't deny, of course, that there is some kind of a basic empathetic, altruistic, you know, when a baby falls, we have to catch it, you know. But the church, I think what you're saying is most often the enemy in these social progresses, because they think morality comes from a command.
Well, yes, and that's yet another, of course, that's another, I guess, theory of the origin of morality, that it comes from, you know, divine edicts. The problem with that, of course, going back to Plato, is why should we trust the divine edicts? If God had a reason for giving us one edict as opposed to another, why don't we just appeal to the reason? Who needs God endorsing it? If he didn't have a reason, then why should we take it seriously? So that's not much better than an appeal to emotion. And indeed, the problem with appeals to emotion, even though they can be stirring. We had Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and moral prophets and entrepreneurs and going back to the biblical prophets. But the problem is that emotion can go many ways. You can rouse up a crowd against the outrage of some ethnic group that you blame for society's misfortunes, or against witches who caused the latest crop failure or epidemic. You could whip out people's emotions for racial purity or class struggle. And it's only if you can justify those emotions with something that can stand criticism that you really have a case that will make the world a better place. And what Rebecca and I, or I should say cartoon versions of Rebecca and I, because we were transformed into animations on the TED site, we kind of went back and forth on this. And she took in our mock debate, she took the case for reason, I took the case for emotion.
Does she usually win the arguments?
So often we think similarly, that there isn't a whole lot where cases where we have a sharp disagreement. So, you know, we tend to develop ideas, bouncing them off each other, and each of us has found in the other a real intellectual soulmate as well as a life soulmate.
So it sounds like science and religion, or science and reason, have much to say about morality. I take it you would disagree with Gould that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria?
Very much. Now, I don't think that morality can be reduced to scientific reasoning or even to logical reasoning, because it's certainly true that there are certain bedrock convictions that you have to have that you can't argue for that get moral arguments started. Like, you know, I'd rather live than die, and I'd rather be happy than unhappy, and I care about interacting with other people, and I'm on
pain, terms with other people. And pain is bad and suffering is bad.
Yeah, pain is bad and suffering is bad. So those things, you know, I don't think I can argue for, but nor are they terribly controversial. They are gut convictions that probably originate in our biology, in the evolutionary imperative to protect oneself, and in the fact that we're social animals and linguistic animals. So we aren't islands. Our happiness depends on coexisting with other people. We have the means both to entertain new thoughts, because we're cognitive animals, and to share those thoughts, because we're linguistic animals. You can't argue for any of those. But on the other hand, they're not controversial. And the question is, once you have that stratum of bedrock gut-level feeling, what follows? And certain things, I think, do follow, like you can't justify slavery or genocide or the oppression of women or gay people. And some are more obvious than others. I think it doesn't take a whole lot of argumentation to show that slavery is wrong, although it did take humanity a few thousand years after the dawn of civilization for everyone to come to that agreement, but eventually came. And more recently, the argument against discriminating against gay people has really quickly reached a tipping point. Something that was controversial not so long ago is very rapidly going the way of slavery and racial segregation, in that the defenders of invidious treatment are becoming fewer and more desperate. And I think that is because of the compelling nature of reason. As long as you have ground rules like free speech, you don't get to shoot people who disagree with you or put them in prison. Under those conditions, and with enough people exchanging opinions and arguing with each other, I tend to think the discussion moves in certain directions.
So that raises the question about whether some of these instincts that we have, or whether they even are instincts, like xenophobia, is that an instinctive thing, or the fear of the different, whatever that might be, sexually different or skin color?
Yeah, I think.
Or is that a social construct?
I think it is an instinct. You see it in very young babies. My colleague Elizabeth Spelke and her students have shown that that even babies will have preferences for people who look and speak the same way as they do, or their caregivers. But like a lot of instincts, it has to do battle in the skull with other instincts and with a part of the brain that we call reason. And even as we have a xenophobic feeling welling up inside us, we can decide that we can clamp down on it in the same way we clamp down on all kinds of antisocial impulses that we have. We might feel uncomfortable during a long lecture. We might have to go to the bathroom. We might feel hunger pangs. We might be sexually aroused by an attractive stranger. And there are all kinds of things we could do to act on those impulses, but thankfully we've got a brain with frontal lobes that can choose not to act on them.
Well, that's what keeps people in one of your classes or in one of my debates from burping out loud, for example.
Exactly.
You have this feeling. Well, we have to take a break here. I'm Dan Barker.
And I'm Andrew Seidel.
We're talking with the Harvard professor and the well-known author, Steven Pinker, and I want to ask you something about the ghost in the machine when we come back after the break. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
And I'm Andrew Seidel.
And we're continuing our conversation with Steven Pinker, the well-known author, the Harvard psychologist and professor, winner of many awards. Time magazine listed him as one of the world's 100 most influential people. And I know that's true because the books of his that I have read, including The Blank Slate, which is, when was that, in the year 2000, 2001?
2002,
which still is in my top list of books. And his most recent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, showing how violence has declined through history, and maybe we can talk about that in a second. But Steve, in your book, The Blank Slate, you talk about three different, I guess, what, myths or misconceptions, and you could just as well have called the book the Ghost in the Machine, because you also debunk that idea that there's something to our consciousness or to our souls. I do a lot of debates, and often philosophers and psychologists will say, one evidence for God is that there are immaterial minds. And last week I debated a Calvinist who said there are such things in the universe called transcendental realities, something that's above and beyond the real world. And I like how you debunked that idea. What is your take on consciousness and the soul?
Yeah, there's no such thing as the soul, except as a poetic way of referring to what we value in an individual human being. But one of the incontrovertible findings of neuroscience is that every aspect of mental life is a direct product of activity in the neural tissue of the brain. So that if you infuse chemicals into the brain, whether they're recreational or therapeutic, then the quality of consciousness changes. If you remove a part of the brain, then a part of the soul disappears. You can record from different parts of the brain and find activity that underlies any mental process you want to name. If you look at the complexity of the brain under a microscope, you see just staggering, breathtaking degree of physical complexity in the 100 billion neurons connected by 100 trillion synapses. And we have every reason to believe that when the physiological activity of the brain stops, the person goes out of existence, which is to say that no one has found a way of communicating with the dead. And Mildred can't tell you in a séance which floorboard she hid the jewels under. If she could, I would, I would change my mind. This is not a matter of faith. If someone without a with an empty skull, without a brain, kind of walked and talked and saw, I would change my mind. If there was some aspect of mental activity, like, say, moral judgments or aesthetic judgments, where no matter how hard you look, you just can't find anything in the brain that corresponds to it, then I'd change my mind too, but that's not the way the science has come out.
But it feels transcendent. I mean, there's just this feeling that we all have, that we're something above and beyond the mere animal.
Yes. Well, there is, I will acknowledge, there is a puzzle, an enigma. I think it's a more of a conceptual puzzle than a scientific one, which is, why does it feel like something to be an active brain? Why am I not a zombie or a robot that's just going through the motions? And the reply to that is, well, how do you know that I'm not a zombie? Right. I know that I'm not a zombie, but I don't know that you're not a zombie. And I think that kind of question pretty much dissolves into a number of brain teasers that make your head hurt, but are not unsolved scientific problems. They're just, it's just a fact about the universe that doesn't sit well with our intuitions, and so much the worse for our intuitions. We certainly have every reason to believe that it's the case.
One thing that I often hear as an atheist is that this naturalistic understanding of the brain and of humanity and the cosmos even, you know, it makes us unhappy. And I wonder if you have a response that you'd like to give to that.
Well, it does make us unhappy. I mean, I would love for it to be a case that someday I'll be reunited with the loved ones who've passed away. But on the other hand, I'm a grown-up, and so I don't want to live with comforting falsehoods. It really sucks that we're going to die. It really sucks that our relatives who died are not going to come back. But a grown-up would rather know those truths and arrange his or her life around them. Namely, given that our moments of consciousness are precious, given that other people with brains like ours have experiences like ours, you arrange your lives and your social institutions in ways that that maximize what people do with the years that they have alive. And I think that leads to better priorities than thinking that this is just an infinitesimal fraction of a much more important realm in the world to come. So you don't have to worry so much about the happiness of people in this world.
Don't you think, at least for me, the fact that life is brief, I mean, we give more value to things that are rare, you know, like precious metals. If life really were eternal, then that would make it cheap. The fact that we know it's going to end makes it even more precious. And instead of sacrificing our lives, we non-believers, for some, you know, promised future or pie in the sky, we make the most of what we have right here, right now.
Well, exactly. You know, the expression, life is short. When do you use it? Well, you use it when you reset your priorities, when you vow to use your time productively rather than squandering it, when you bury the hatchet in some pointless dispute, when you vow to spend time with your loved ones. If life is infinite, then just think of all of the waste, or if you thought that life was infinite, whereas in fact it isn't, think of all the pointless disputes and displaced priorities and lack of opportunities to convey affection to a loved one, which you're motivated to do knowing that life is short. So the life is short saying is I think a real prompt, a real impetus to know what you ought to value in life.
Yeah, and we're thrilled that you accepted your position as FFRF Honorary President. I wonder if you would discuss your decision to support FFRF in that manner.
Well, a lot of it hinged on the fact that I won't be responsible for actually running anything, because I want to reassure listeners who value, as I do, the Freedom from Religion Foundation, that it will not be placed in the hands of me or my administrative capabilities, which leave a lot to be desired.
But you do know that you're welcome to come to any of our board meetings.
Which I hope to do, as long as you're not going to rely on me to run anything efficiently.
Well, you're a business.
I'm very happy. I was very happy to just add my name to endorse the goals of the foundation, to stand up for it, to encourage it, to represent it to the extent that that's a good thing, and just to be whatever help I can.
Well, it makes a huge difference to have someone of your stature vouching for the foundation. Are you working on a new project? You must be.
I am. I have a book coming out in September on writing style, how to write with clarity and grace, applying our knowledge from linguistics and cognitive science. So that's what's going to differentiate it from the traditional style manuals. It's not just based on recycling old rules or on the common sense of a writer, but they are also motivated by what cognitive science have discovered about how language works and how the mind works.
Well, I hope it's easy to read. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
thank you for that. We're talking with Steve Pinker, the author, the Harvard professor, and now honorary president of the Freedom from Religion Foundation. We also want to thank our engineer, Dave McCann, for running our show today, Buzz Kemper for announcing. You can find out more about the Freedom from Religion Foundation and this show at ffrf.org.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. Support Free Thought Radio's broadcasts and podcasts by becoming a member, and support our important state church litigation like Pismo Beach, and become part of the largest Free Thought Association in North America, the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Check us out at our website, ffrf.org.
Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope someday.